I was thinking just now of Maizumi Roshi and whom I never met. But I've heard that, I used to hear that when he gave a talk, there were often a lot of pauses and he had a lot of papers and he was looking for things and sometimes people couldn't really understand what he was saying. His English was not so great, or he spoke very softly. And I read recently that the Japanese scholar who did a lot to bring Zen to the West, D.T. Suzuki, when he gave talks, it was something very similar, where it wasn't so much that his English was not good, but he had a lot of papers and he would give a long explanation of something and then there would be a long pause. And then he would go roundabout talking about something and then there would be a pause. And then suddenly at the end, there would be some boom, something that he would say. And I don't know if this is a Japanese way of giving talks. I don't really care. I thought it was interesting that they both had that approach. And when I first started giving talks, which was 16 years ago at this time of year, in April, I always had a lot of pauses in my talks. I didn't have a lot of papers because that was not the way that Geno Roshi trained us. We were not to prepare anything. But there were often a lot of pauses. And I was pausing because I was waiting for something to arise. It wasn't because I didn't know what to say so much or I was trying to figure out how to say it. I was waiting to see what came up and then would say it. And someone who had been a longtime student of Maizumi Roshi said to me once, after hearing my talks, that those pauses that I made reminded her of Maizumi Roshi's talks. So I thought, well, maybe that's what Maizumi Roshi was doing too, I don't know. Or maybe it's some tick that has been handed down in our lineage, I don't know. I say that because I was thinking of Maizumi Roshi because of the anniversary of his death and forms and rituals and things like that, and how those are transmitted and what is transmitted. And what's the point? If you look at the history of Zen, let's say, which theoretically is a Buddhist school, it came first from, started in India, with who we say was the historical Buddha. Although in Buddhism, it doesn't really matter if that person actually lived or not. It's not like in Christianity where it's essential that Christ lived, that the Messiah came and lived. Buddhism, it doesn't really matter if he was real or not. However, there's evidence that he was real, that he existed. In any case, was India, or what we today call India. He developed from his awakening, when his seeing the nature of things, after having first said, I won't say anything because everyone has to find it for themselves, there's no point in telling people about it, he then accepted to drop that position and talk to people. And given the circumstances he was in, it was quite radical because he went against the Indian system of castes, where you were just born into your caste and there was no option. That's just what you did. And he went radically against that, asking everyone who came to him to remove all appearance of what their caste was so that they all were the same. Because his realization was that everyone is awakened or has the potential to awaken, however you want to look at it, regardless of their position, the way they look, the way they dress, what they do, whatever. So he asked them all to take off their usual garments. The rich Brahmins had to give up their garments. The poor people gave up their rags. And everyone wore the same thing. Whatever was given, basically. And everyone ate the same thing. Everyone did the same thing. When it rained, they had to have a certain practice because there's the rainy season. Often they were not accepted in whatever villages they went to because they were so radical and they were undermining the caste system with their positions. And so they were forced to leave and they would have to move on to another place. And eventually, centuries and centuries, the Buddha himself never wrote anything down. So we have no trace of what he actually said, except what people said that he said. Eventually, after several centuries, many centuries, what we're then calling Buddhism moved on to China, other countries as well, but because we're talking about Zen, we'll go to China. And there as well, it existed for some time, still based on the sutras, essentially the texts that had been written about what the Buddha had said. And most of the practices involved studying these texts, memorizing them, being able, they said that there are people who could repeat them backwards and forwards, who were erudite, studied them, whatever. And rituals that were related to that. Of course, the climate is different in China. The caste system was different in China. And the clothing was different. Everything was different, and so probably didn't look exactly like it did in India, I don't know personally, but... and then after several centuries of this, along comes this Indian monk who says, it's not about the texts or the rituals. It's not about studying and learning something. It's about illumination of the mind. It's about illumination of here. Outside the sutras, he said something like that. Which was also radical. This threw a spoke into everyone's wheel in China at the time. And he just sat down. We say he sat down in front of the wall. And he said, this is all it is. And we have the famous story of, the emperor who has built all these monasteries and collected relics and done fabulous things built great temples, and the Bodhidharma says there's no merit in that. And the emperor says, well, what is the essential teaching then? Nothing holy, vast emptiness. Nothing sacred. So all of these sacred texts and rituals and relics and all of this, suddenly, that's not what it's about, Bodhidharma's saying. And then this, over time, this tangent took hold. And the Chinese began practicing in this way. Because Chinese society was organized, however, in basically was agrarian, and in agrarian communities, people who almost like a communist kind of system, where the communities lived together and they were self-sustaining and they provided everything in their communities, that was the model that the Buddhists adapted. And because Confucianism and Taoism were the primary practices of the society, Buddhism was frowned upon, basically. And there were even moments when they were repressed and massacred and whatever. So they pretty much stuck to themselves and created their own agrarian communities, which were stable. There was none of this moving around anymore. There was no rainy season that they had to flee or stay put for or anything. And created their communities in that way. Still with the model, the cultural model was still kind of the wild man hermit, either Confucianism or Taoism, and very much nature-based, the Chinese system was. And so then that affected how they practiced their Buddhism as well. And it also, they ate different food than people ate in China, in India, and cultivated different plants and had different, integrated different rituals from their other traditions, whatever. Eventually then, you know, there was the golden age of, what we call the golden age of Chan, which, was in the 9th century, pretty much. And it began to flourish, and there was an emperor who protected it all, and the koan system, the koans were flourishing. There were a lot of different masters, people, a lot of monks. And then several centuries later, along comes a monk from Japan who has already been practicing a form of Buddhism in Japan, isn't satisfied with it, and comes to China, encounters. There's a famous story of encounters an old monk who's buying mushrooms from him on a boat, and eventually goes to his monastery, stays there, has a great realization, again, about the dropping off of body and mind. It's no longer about these rituals. It's not about the rituals and wearing the right kind of robe and bowing a certain way or studying a certain text. Again, it's about the dropping off of it. He goes back to Japan and revolutionizes the way that Buddhism is practiced for certain people, because other sects still persist in Japan, but the way that this particular Zen practice is practiced. And then when, but of course he is influenced by the Japanese traditions and very much by the samurai and the disciplines and a certain aesthetic that the Chinese didn't have, which comes from the insular island nature of the country, of the landscape, of all the particular karmic influences of the people of Japan. And then it evolves again. No longer are we so focused on the wild man hermit, but it's more on a disciplined, rigorous, almost rigid position, which is not rigid in the way we think it is. It's just a different way of applying discipline with the same goal. With the same goal is in the sense of no goal, the goal being to let go of the goal and see into the true nature of things, of this. Okay, then of course that, you know, and now we are where we are. There are many different passages of Buddhism in various places, but now we are where we are, more or less, having passed into the West. The same goes for all, anything, for Christianity, for Judaism, for Islam, for Tibetan Buddhism, for anything. Wherever it goes, something different happens. However, it's particular in Buddhism and particularly in Zen, because the point is on the nature, seeing into the nature of things, which are impermanent and changing all the time, and change according to the circumstances particularly. So, of course, it's not going to be the same wherever it is. All this is, this is like the 5-minute vulgar history of Buddhism. Take what you want from it. It ties in with my own personal story in the sense that when I came to this practice, I knew nothing about anything of the practice, whatever. But I had this experience of the true nature of things. And so no one had to tell me that it had nothing to do with the rituals and the forms, because that was my experience. It had nothing to do with any of this. And however, because I was looking for a teacher and I met this teacher, because I had this connection with her, I just did whatever she was doing. I don't think, however, that it was by accident that I connected with her. It had to do with what she was doing. Had I met the teacher that Patrick mentioned this morning, Tenke Roshi, I probably would not have stayed with him, because it wasn't, I had no affinity with the forms in the way that he has an affinity, Tenke. I'm just saying that as an example because it comes to mind, but, you know, had I met, a Tibetan Lama or something, I don't think I would have gone that way. It didn't appeal to me. This is a way of saying that all of the forms are valid, and all the manifestations of the teaching are valid. Everyone has an affinity for something or another, and whatever way is being presented is valid if that is for you, if that appeals to you, if that speaks to you, it's valid. I'm just saying for me what spoke to me, what had meaning for me, let's say. And therefore is what I continue to teach. We all only teach what is our own experience. I couldn't teach anything else. Someone who has not had experience with koans could not work with koans. I could not teach, I could not do a Green Tara transmission in the Tibetan school. I could not sit down and do a seminar on mindfulness-based stress reduction meditation. I don't do that, right? I don't know anything about that. But I do know, in a sense, not intellectually, but my experience is that the whole point of all of this is, let me say awakening, but the awakening is to the true nature of things. Who are you? What is it? This is what it is. This is the whole point. So we have what we call skillful means. We use anything we can get our hands on, our head on, our mouth on, as a means to help people awaken to that. Ultimately, none of it is any good. You know, it's kind of like John Geronimo's yesterday. It's all a failure, in fact, because it doesn't really have anything to do with the forms. The forms are just there to help us to realize that. And I, you know, the story that I often tell, many of you have probably heard it. Last fall when I was in Lisbon, I met a Zen teacher there who, from a different lineage, who invited me to lunch. He'd been wanting to meet me for years and couldn't figure it out. And we had lunch and then we were talking, and he's been there for quite some time, and he has a big center and there's a lot of people who come there. And he has a big international organization behind him, so you know, it's a big thriving thing. And he, like me, is a member of the Buddhist Union there, and once a year, usually, I am invited by the Buddhist Union and I give a conference or a workshop or something, because all the groups that are members of the union try to support the Buddhist Union and share our teachings and whatever. And over lunch, it came out that he had never been there to give a talk or a workshop or anything at the Buddhist Union. And he's been there in Lisbon for 15 years. And so I was surprised at that. And he said, oh, well, you know, I forget exactly how he explained it to me, but the reason was is that for him, in his tradition, he can only give a talk, he can only do a workshop, he wouldn't even say a workshop, I don't think, in a specific room that has a specific dimension with a specific altar and a particular kind of Buddha, and so he can't. He doesn't think of that as being, for him, it's just perfectly normal, and it's unthinkable that he would give a talk there. And it's almost laughable that I wouldn't give a talk there. They don't have the right room, they don't have the right altar, they don't have the right Buddha, anything. But, and I thought that was so sad, to be limited by the form to that extent, to not be able to share what his experience of being is. I mean, I don't know what his experience of, I don't know what he would say, I never heard his talk, but which limits very much the access to the teachings if it's limited to that much, limited to that extent. So I guess in a sense we are diametrically opposed, he and I. Not in the sense that there's a conflict, but we are two ends of a spectrum, maybe. And we have this experience, in fact, when we do the circle, the council circle, with we have the form, which is very important. The forms are always important. Within that form, we don't know what will arise. And we try to let go of our expectations of what will arise. for me and for the others. And what emerges from this oneness of the form, which with every voice equal, there's no, theoretically, no hierarchy, there's this incredible diversity that emerges. Because no one talks the same way, no one says the same thing, no one moves in the same way, no one, even if they take the same object, they don't take it in the same way. It's numberless, the differences. If we were fixed on a certain thing that had to be said, and things that could be said and couldn't be said, we move into dangerous territory. This ultimately brings us to totalitarianism. I say that because, of course, the forms, there is no diversity without form, and there is no form without diversity. It's another way of saying emptiness and form. So when we do when we bring in rituals and forms in our practice like this, they are just means by which, like I said this morning, all of this, these diverse manifestations of emptiness can come together and realize their oneness. For me as a teacher, if the forms don't do that, then I don't keep them. And of course, I'm making a judgment on what I think is a form that does that and a form that doesn't. Somebody else could have another judgment on which form does that and doesn't. And everyone is free to do that, which gives us this amazing flourishing of diversity of teachings and teachers and groups and possibilities. All with going to the same place. What is the nature of all? When you see the nature of that, when you see that everything is without self and everything is impermanent, well, that changes everything. Subject is vast. And as I've told before too, I once was present when my teacher's teacher, so Genpo Roshi, said to Tenke, Patrick mentioned this morning, if you were paralyzed in your bed, what would be your teaching to your students? What would be your teaching for your students? And I think, if I remember correctly, this came after Tenke had given a talk about form or something. I don't know, whatever. I don't remember exactly what the context was, but that it struck me, the question. And is a reminder for myself. I mean, it struck me, I think, because it spoke to me. Whatever the circumstance, what is the teaching? So, you know, if you can walk and talk and use your arms and you're healthy, what is your teaching? If you can't, what is your teaching? If you're sick, what is your teaching? If you live on a mountain, what is your teaching? If you live in the desert, what is your teaching? What is your teaching? We, instead of teaching, we could say, what is your practice, maybe? What is it? We could even take away practice. What is it? Like the lovely story I love of...
Sounds like a koan already.
What?
Sounds already like a koan.
It is. But life is a koan. You know? This is the Genjo koan of Dogen Zenji. But the story that I love too of Maizumi Roshi with Tenshin, who's one of his successors, he told me this story, Tenshin, that he was at one point, Tenshin was Maizumi Roshi's assistant, his jisha, and he was at the mountain center, they have a center in the mountains, and there was Maizumi Roshi with his two brothers, who are also Roshis, and their favorite activity, it was night, and their favorite activity was to sit around drinking sake, probably, and probably chatting, I don't know what they were doing, but they had this game where suddenly out of nowhere, one of them would say to another, what is it? And then the one was supposed to respond. And no one knew who was going to ask it or who he was going to ask. And at one point, and so Tenshin is doing his job, you know, he's getting the sake and refilling and whatever he's supposed to be doing. And suddenly, Maizumi Roshi stops and turns to Tenshin and says, Tenshin, what is it? And Tenshin was not expecting to be included in this game and freezes and says, I like the sound of the crickets at night. There were probably crickets, you know, going out in the mountains at night. And Maizumi Roshi said to him, Tenshin, don't cheat. And Tenshin said, I'm not cheating, Roshi. And Maizumi Roshi said, if you cheat, I lose. Which is a fab. I mean, I love this story. This is just a modern day koan. If I ever do a collection of koans someday, I will include it with Tenshin's permission. But. If Tenshin's still alive at that time. Bless his soul, I hope that he still will be, but he's older than me. So Tenshin at this point probably was a fairly long-time practitioner. And so he knows that when, you know, the teacher asks a question like that, you're supposed to just say, whatever's here right now, you know, okay, a glass of water or something like that. You know, this is, you get in this habit of it's just this, just this, just this. But just this becomes a concept, right? As I often say with my teacher when I was working on koans, I used to try that for every koan. It was always, well, it's just this. What's the answer? This. Just, it was always no. Ding, 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 ding. And it was, you know, and I would get frustrated. It's just this. No. Just this. No. It becomes a concept, right? And so Maizumi Roshi apparently is hearing tension and testing to see, is this a concept? Or he hears that it's a concept, that he's not really responding to what it is, you know? And then tension kind of, as we say in French, il aggrave son cas. He makes it even worse by saying, I'm not cheating, Roshi. and then beautifully, Maizumi Roshi if you cheat, I lose. Maizumi Roshi's dharma, his life, his practice is to not lose a drop of this, right? And so if the guy is cheating, there's a drop getting lost there. He's not really doing it. And so Maizumi Roshi then is losing a drop. Of course, it's not about I, and Maizumi Roshi knows this. He's framing it in this way. He's using a form that can be understood by more or less, because you can't get your head around it. If you cheat, I lose. You can't get your head around it, really. At the same time, he knows the devotion that his disciple has towards him, and that his disciple doesn't want him to lose. Probably tension, more than tension not wanting himself to lose, he doesn't want Maizumi Roshi to lose. So at that point, he will do whatever is necessary so that Maizumi Roshi doesn't lose. I mean, I'm assuming a lot of this, but I think probably that's the case. We can recognize that in ourselves with our practice. And there's nothing wrong with tension's response. At that moment, that's what it is. I like the sound of the crickets at night. Why not? Why not? But Maizumi Roshi's not going to let him sit with that. No. Don't cheat. It's funny that story came up because it's, you know, I guess Maizumi Roshi is like here now, something, you know, so.
What was the response of Tenkei when Genpo asked him what would be your teaching if you were lying in bed?
He didn't say anything.
He didn't say anything?
No. Oh, okay. It was kind of an embarrassing situation for him because there were other people around. There were other people. You know, if I was there, you know that it wasn't really very private. Huh? And but Genpo has a tendency to do that.
Yeah.
Put people in uncomfortable situations. So I think that Tenkei was speechless. Maybe if he had just been with Genpo, he maybe could have responded. Or maybe his response was just no, there's just silence. Maybe. I don't know. I was so struck by Genpo's comment that I kind of thought, wow, what would I do?
You were sensei back then,
Tenkei? He was definitely sensei.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if he was Roshi yet, but he was definitely sensei, yeah.
Maizumi Roshi says, if you cheat, I lose. I lose what? I lose. Qu'est-ce que c'est, je perds?
Well, you can look at it, you know, I give the example of losing a drop of water, losing a drop of this precious wine that is being transmitted, if that helps to situate it. It's a game. They're playing a game,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Ils perdent en jeu avec les autres, c'est ça?
That's one way of saying it.
Mais ça peut être aussi perdre la substance, le moment de vie.
There you go.
Ça, oui.
So it's however you take that. It's much more than, you know, it's with all koans. It's, you know, it's apparently saying something, but that's not really what it's saying. Or it's not all that it's saying. Because, you know, ultimately there are no, if we look at it from an absolute point of view, there's no winner or loser. There's no such thing as winning or losing. But from a relative point of view, which is where the forms and the rituals lie, there is. You know, and where we are, and where there is awakening and ignorance and delusion and enlightenment, and there is.
In a way, maybe he would have been recognized that he was, I don't remember the name you employed.
Which story now?
Your story.
With tension?
No.
With the drop?
Yeah. You lose.
Oh.
And if the disciple would have been recognized, yes, of course, maybe by this way, he would have win.
Wait, say that again, I'm not sure.
Bon, je vais le dire en français.
Okay.
Peut-être qu'au moment où Maizome Roshi lui a dit « si tu triches », c'est comme ça que j'ai traduit le mot,
oui.
« je perds », peut-être que c'est à ce moment-là il avait entendu ça et qu'il ait reconnu ça. Peut-être qu'à ce moment-là, il aurait, alors je mets « gagné » entre guillemets, mais il aurait... Ben voilà, ça serait vraiment ça. Pour le coup.
Mm. Peut-être.
Sans tricherie.
Peut-être, oui. So Brigitte is saying if in, instead of saying, I'm not cheating, Roshi, Tenshin had recognized that whatever, would have validated what Maizumi Roshi was saying or something, it would have, he may have then, there would not have been anything lost, as she's suggesting. You mean like in the acknowledging of it?
Yeah.
The owning of it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, acknowledging it.
Mm-hmm.
And being with this, for him, this disappointment. Okay, I have been seen even before I know I was tricky.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of a story I read yesterday about... Joseph Goldstein and with his teacher and what it was the disciple was presenting a Koran and it didn't work at all, and the master to help him said him how does a Buddha is singing or something like that, and Joseph Goldstein understood that he has to present the Koran by singing, but it was a big deal for him because he didn't sing at all. He was really wrong in that, but he trained by himself, just singing something, two lines, and went to present its Koran, and he was completely confused and sang wrong and mixed the word. It was a pity, and he was really, really confused, and his master said it, bravo, that's it, and he passed the Koran.
Do you know who the teacher, the Zen teacher was?
Yeah, I forgot, Epstein, no. It was Mark Epstein himself with his teacher Joseph Goldstein.
But they don't work with koans.
Well, he's a Vipassana teacher.
Sorry?
Mm. Joseph is a Vipassana
so
teacher.
So he must have been practicing with a Zen teacher, which
yeah,
they do, huh?
Maybe
those guys
I
do.
Don't
but
remember.
Yeah. Okay, interesting.
Or Joseph Goldstein, Mark Epstein said this story. And he had this story from Joseph Goldstein and
who
his
had
teacher.
Been, okay, who had been with a Zen teacher. Yeah.
Ajahn Chah did often things like that too.
Yeah, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, interesting. And I was... As you were talking, I thought of this. That and it reminded me, I was still came back to Genpo embarrassing people, because when I received transmission and I did all the ceremonies and all the thing, you know, and Genpo was there and he totally, you know, approved of everything and whatever, but then after, like, I think we were having breakfast or something, a group of people with Genpo and me and Roshi and, you know, a few other people. And he said, but, you know, Catherine, addressing Geno Roshi, my teacher, you know, yeah, she's great, she'll be a great teacher, she's a great, you know, whatever, everything's fine, but you really got to teach her how to bow. because it's really embarrassing even to say it, but you know, when we go down and we bow and we raise our hands, right? You know this story? Yeah. So I, no one had ever showed me how to do it, you know, like I said, I came to this with just knowing nothing, and I just kind of copied what people did and whatever. And no one ever said anything to me about it, and all of these posterior, you know, these bowing that you have to do in the transmission, it's just, you know, count of millions probably of bowing that you have to do. And so what it turns out is that I was doing this. And he was so, and so Genpo's made some joke about, yes, so you really have to teach her to bow, because otherwise she's going to be throwing the Buddha away all the time.
Angel does that too. Angel is great.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Angel does the same thing. And even with the teacher like Engyoku.
Oh, I'm not the only
that's
one.
That's the flexibility.
However, I say this because, you know, this is kind of like Joseph Goldstein, you know, like all over the place with his song. The meaning for me in the bowing and the ritual of it was not changed by the fact that I was doing this, you know. Ultimately, my experience is, of course, it's different physically to do this instead of do this. But, you know, I kind of wondered why my elbows were like raw at the end of the week after all the bowing. that doesn't happen anymore. But, you know, one of the most powerful experiences I've had in my practice was during the week, all day while everyone was sitting in meditation, I was in the special little transmission room bowing, you know, and having to say a mini version of the lineage, ending with my teacher, I forget, I think we have to say it like a certain number of times, I forget, Geno, she's sensei at the time, Geno sensei, Daisho, or whatever, I don't remember exactly what it was, but it doesn't matter. But I had to repeat her name 7 times or something at the end, and then start over again. And this all day, bowing and saying this, bowing and saying this, bowing and saying this. You know, I had great thighs at the end of the week, and raw elbows. And, but, wow, this amazing, powerful experience of, you know, I gave a talk on it after, and what I just kept saying was, it's all about love. But it's not love in the way that we think of it, you know? It's not like everybody loves each other, but that everything, even, you know, I forget, it doesn't really matter so much what I said, but the fact is that there was this powerful experience in the bowing, even though I was doing the bowing wrong, let's say. And Joseph Goldstein, he sang this song all wrong. Probably, I don't know. But...
and Genpo didn't tell you anything while seeing it.
He didn't, I'm glad for that.
Right.
Yeah. He didn't say
he
it.
He said
like...
it at the end.
Did he say it publicly in front of everybody?
No, what you're saying, the way you're telling the story.
Yeah.
He saw it the whole time.
Yeah.
Like, for a week,
yeah.
And then he's
yeah.
telling you
finally,
that at the end.
Right, he finally told my teacher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, teacher how to bow, you know. No, that's true. He didn't say it in front of the whole assemblée.
And that must mean, that can mean something, because if he thought it would be so important,
he would have done it immediately.
Yeah.
Stop, you can't
so
do that.
So he
yeah.
knew
what
that
concept.
Was not the point.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, probably.
I find it's a very loving way to mm-hmm. teach, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's very accepting.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know, now this is just my thought, but if he tells you something in the beginning, it might lead your mind to question if you are able, no? Because I don't even know how to bow and at the end, you know, you've done everything, and then he said, oh, this is something you can manage better.
Yeah, and I don't know.
My experience in this lineage, there's also a lot of about blaming. Really, I don't have the idea about blaming. There's a lot of idealization, how we interpret what a teacher does afterwards. But there's also a lot about blaming. They're just normal people. And I sometimes, and that's just their stick. And if that was Gimpo's stick, he just did it. And sometimes Gyoku did this too. You can say it was a teaching, because one is to blame.
What do you mean by blame?
Kind of blaming you, putting you into shame in public, putting out your faults in form. Like that you don't bow the right way. It's kind of, he could, if he thinks that, he could tell you privately, but he chooses to do it in public, to point out your faults. And that's kind of a blaming. It's a very uncomfortable situation. You can idealize it and say it is a teaching. And it is a teaching. It depends on how you receive it. But
yeah,
if it is fair all the time, that's the other question. And if it's necessary.
Yeah, and you know.
Gyoku did it often.
I don't want to turn this into like a generalization about Kenpo. The way that I received it, I wouldn't say idealizing it. It was more, I mean, everything is a teaching in that respect. So I wouldn't say that was more of a teaching than something else. I know that, because I know Gyempo well, and I know that's how he functions. Personally, I don't function that way. And I received it as I think probably he observed me bowing during the, probably not as much as I think he did. You know, I think he probably wasn't paying nearly as much attention as I think he was paying attention. because of course we always are more focused on ourselves than other people are focused on us. But I'm assuming, I feel, maybe it's not even an assumption, I feel that he saw whatever I was doing, that it didn't matter. My heart was in it or something, you know, that I was fully expressing myself at that moment, even if I was, you know, doing this. And he chose to say it when he did. It's not. It's neither good nor bad. For me, I didn't receive it as good or bad. Other things, you know, that I don't like about things that Gyempo did, and I choose that I say it and then I go away or something. You know, I mean, you don't have to like it all. Although Gyempo's new book, I hear, is about the spitting out the bones. You know, the famous thing of you're supposed to swallow it all, swallow the whole fish, swallow the teacher, swallow the teaching, everything, and then spit out the bones.
La fin de la phrase, c'est quoi? Tu es censé avaler tout et recracher
les
oreilles.
Oui.
C'est son nouveau livre?
Oui. Which is very much, you know, that fits with the very, you know, Zen samurai thing, you know, you just take it all and then spit out the bones. I haven't read the book, I've only read the first few pages that somebody sent me, but
meaning you pick and choose?
No, meaning you don't pick and choose, you just take it all.
And then you spit.
Well, yes. The way that I'm
naturally
what I'm seeing is just in the first bits that I read of it, is that he's talking more about, like, he's seeing the bones as being his shadows coming out. Like his, because he certainly has a lot of shadow stuff going on, Genpo. And that having gone through this, you know, huge ordeal where he was told he could no longer be in the White Plum lineage and all this stuff, the book is apparently about, using this metaphor of the bones as being all of what we would think of as being negative, you know, his problems with women, his problems with money, whatever. And he's seeing those as the bones, that the bones of the lineage, if you will, you know, like you're saying. The bones of what, he swallowed the whole fish, he swallowed the good stuff and the bad stuff. And the bones are coming out, you know. Apparently that's what he's saying. I only read the first little bit, so I don't really know. So we have 8 minutes. Anyone like to say anything else?
Yeah, I have a question. If we put the center is opening soon.
The center is what?
Opening soon. The Wildflower Zen Center will be opening soon. And let's be crazy and imagine tons of people are joining the Sangha.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, and to what extent do you transmit the form? How will it go? How does it work?
Well, I can't know because I respond to the situation. So, for it as it is now, the way that I see that space is, it will be essentially like it is here with, you know, black cushions and a room with an altar and that. Which is a big change for us because we're used to going into other people's spaces and transforming them into a sitting place. So this will be the first time we have had a place that is like that. And if other people want to use the space, well, they have to take those things away, install their stuff, and then when they finish, put our stuff back. So that already is a change. In terms of retreats, basically we will have weekend retreats like this. People generally won't be staying there. They could, but that's kind of an extreme measure because we don't have a shower. They could sleep there, but there's no shower, so that's a problem. We can cook, so we will basically do what we do here. You know, it will, and that also is a change for us because when we do retreats in Paris now, we don't cook. Everyone brings food and we share it. And we don't sit at night because we don't start early in the morning and we don't sit at night because we don't have any possibility to cook breakfast or dinner. So that too will change. So it'll be more like this format. So already given the space, the forms that we use will evolve. Just even if we have the same number of people. If we have more people, well then we will have to have more cushions. Or at least more mats, if people want to sit on chairs. we'll have to see. I have a hard time believing that we will have so many people that we can't fit in that room. But if that happens, then we may have to find another space.
I'm saying also in terms of introduction course to
ceremony
or to eating or yoki or to bowing.
Yeah. Well, in that sense, yes, that is part of the plan too, is because we have this new space and I will have more time, I am planning to introduce, you know, different sorts of workshops, courses, things. We also can have, for those of us who are already practicing together, we can have sessions like that where we review things if we want to, so that all of you can then transmit the forms. So I don't have to always be the one giving the introduction to meditation, or, I mean, you know, Joa already does some of this, or the Orioki or whatever, you know. So because we will have Orioki there, yes, we will have to do more training with Orioki for the new people who come. The way that it has functioned for me is the form, as it has for the history of Buddhism, the form is organic and arises from the necessity of the circumstances. And so that's how it will be there too. I don't know any other way to function. You know, for the moment, we don't have an altar, we don't have a Buddha statue. We have a box of incense at Joe's house. we have a few candles there. I'm sure we have a lighter.
You have a calligraphy, beautiful calligraphy.
I have a beautiful calligraphy that Patrice gave me. That's right. And also the Heart Sutra one that you gave me too. So we have some things we can put on the walls, you know, if we want to do that. We have, I don't know, that's about all we have. So we will see what, you know, what evolves. If we don't have a Buddha statue in the beginning, well, we'll do, you know, what we do in the Dokusan room down there. We have a rock there, and maybe someone will donate something.
Before we finish, I'd like to say one thing about form also, one aspect we did not address very much. Is I remember when I was in Paris with Lama Surya Das, doing a Dzogchen with him, very often he will take me to the church in Saint-Germain, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we would sit there in the church, and he said, Patrick, you know, I like church so much, and the dimension, the holy smell. I cannot find another word right now, so I say just the holy smell. You when you go in a church, you know. And I spent six years of my life in monasteries, Zen monasteries, and. In most of them, there was this holy smell, the holy smell, and I connect it with the lineage, and it's very, for me, it was very, very moving, you know, this aspect of form is very moving, you know.
Mm.
I would be very, disappointed, maybe, I don't know, I can't find another word, if this aspect will disappear in the West.
Mm. Me too, because that would mean the end of Zen, if that disappeared.
Mm. You know, when I left at CCR, there were often Japanese monks, and I mean, I was trained pretty strictly. But when the monks came, they were often trained in Sojiji and Eheji, so they were very, very strictly trained. And Roshi once said, you see the maturity of their practice on how flexible they are to adjust to the place where they come to.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really true. There is not one thing, as you say. And that was really sweet with those guys who came. They were really at ease. They were at ease with themselves, and they could adjust to the place. And what I often saw here in the West, people train for 25 years righteousness, how to do the form right.
you can dream that if you want. But it's what you say. Can you be flexible to the place where what that offers the practice to you, because there is no fixed thing? And yet, I miss the form. It's in my flesh and in my bones. I did it every day for many times. I miss the ceremonies. I miss the community life. So there's something about form. But make your form so you can love it. I think that is the thing, to love your form.
Well, if we weren't alive, there would be no form. So there's form everywhere,
right,
at every moment. You are form. So I understand we can have an attachment to a certain form. We miss a certain form.
Right. But so what? Is that the point?
It's time to stop. According to this form, it's time to stop. Thank you.